Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 3 issues for just £5. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today. Hello and welcome back to Black's History Week. In this podcast, Professor Jeremy Black, author of Altered States, talks to The Critic's political editor, Graham Stewart, about how posterity, or at any rate some historians, will treat the presidency of Donald Trump. Revolutionary? Visionary? Perpetuator of a long-established isolationist tradition, or the architect of a realist foreign policy for the 21st century? An aberration, or a symptom of the deeper and unresolved divisions in American society that consensus politics did not, and may not, overcome?
Professor Jeremy Black, in this series we've been looking at all the presidents of the United States and how they have used executive authority during their term or terms in the White House. We come now to what might in some ways be seen as a more difficult task, assessing from a historical perspective the term of office of Donald Trump. Difficult for two reasons. At the time of recording this, he hasn't yet conceded defeat. Secondly, our perspective is an immediate one rather than one that gives us a greater distance from our subject. But with that in mind, I'd like to start by saying, what do you think are the aspects of Donald Trump's presidency which have seemed in the news cycle to be important, but which on the long view of history will not accorded so much significance?
Well, that's an excellent question. Can I just begin, for the benefit of the listeners, to exactly identify when we are speaking? We are speaking on the Friday after the election. And when you said President Trump has not conceded, I mean, one might make the joke that he may never concede. So, I mean, let's not judge this. The election might be determined without the, and the president might, to his dying day, refuse to concede it. But anyway, let's also make a another point, which is necessary for listeners to hear, that we're obviously both British. We are not in any way implying that the politics of our own country is better or, for that matter, worse, nor are we sitting here in some kind of smug judgment. If you think of our last election when we had the baleful Jeremy Corbyn, a sort of Marxist subsequently castigated for anti-Semitism, as somebody who could well have been prime minister, I don't think we should actually regard ourselves as praiseworthy. And if you think about the situation on the continent, where regularly elections are in fact just the prelude to lengthy periods of horse trading between coalitions, many of which operate in a fashion that some of us might regard as corruptible, I think we have to therefore be very cautious about some of the evaluations of the United States. And I also think that in fact both the candidates paradoxically deserve congratulations. They have each received a substantial number of votes. I think I'm right in saying it's about 72.5 million to 70 million. I think I'm right in saying it's the largest number ever cast, which shows that, although obviously some of those votes may well reflect the anxiety, it also shows their ability to elicit support. So I think to the president, Donald Trump, and to the man who I assume is going to be president-elect, Joe Biden, I think we owe some congratulations. But now, let us move on to the specific point that you raised. What do I think as a historian? Well, first of all, you asked history. You presented it as an abstraction. I am an historian. I do not speak for history. All too often, just as one thinks it's ludicrous when one listens to politicians presuming or assuming to speak for history. I mean, one T. Blair was particularly guilty of that. One sees the same thing of historians. So my assumption would be that and in fact the history is instant at the moment, but when history is of this period is subsequently discussed in academic circles, in wider non-academic circles, there is no reason to believe there will be any one verdict. Right. Having made all those points, I think you would probably find, and here one's looking simply at academics, all right? I think you would find that academics, if they're good, many of them, I think one can put a big question mark against that, will always be looking for similarities. They'll always be looking for comparisons. They'll always be looking at elements that, as it were, more move away from the grand Gothic. And obviously the present conduct of the president is the grand Gothic. They'll be moving away from the grand Gothic and trying to look at other aspects of their policies and their periods in office. So, for example, I've already suggested when we were discussing geopolitics, the continuity between President Obama and President Trump in the so-called pivot to Asia. And I think one would be able to find other continuities, and those continuities will both be, as it were, to use an ugly phrase, backward-looking. In other words, Trump plus Obama, and also forward-looking, as it were, Trump plus Biden, because, for both presidents is the question about how best to engage with China, and by engage with, I might mean engage against, will be very much to the fore in international relations. So I think there will be, and I don't wish to disappoint listeners here, possibly less of an emphasis on the aspects that most engage attention at the present moment. Where I can add a caveat, though, is this, that one assumes that there will be scholarship that will, as with all presidents, and President Trump is no different from anybody else here, disclose from archival or other sources of more or less veracity elements that at the present moment we know little about, or that might throw a light on what we currently know about. And it's very difficult to gauge which directions they may go in. It's very difficult to gauge their veracity. And we're talking about archival sources, both official and unofficial. We're talking about those both in the United States and outside the United States. So all of those will be part of the mix.
So, picking you up on that very point, where obviously we don't know what archival releases may reveal. Do you think there'll be in time?
Well, I think we know some of the things they'll reveal. I mean, for example, we know that they will reveal the diplomatic correspondence between the American government and American diplomats. We know, we know quite a lot of what will be revealed in terms of the class of documents. What we don't know about is the content of the documents.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there'll be a focus on Trump's foreign policy or more on his domestic policy? Because it seems to me that pivot away from China, the pivot away from various forms of international cooperation, which had been set during the Clinton years, is a clear area where a new line was devised in Washington. Do you think that's fair, or will a lot depend on how Trump's successors, plural, will run with this?
Well, yeah, I think that's very interesting, and I think partly it depends upon the sophistication of the analysis. I mean, any analysis of international relations has to, as it were, give weight to the other players in the room, the other, international states and so on. So that, for example, we could discuss now, we would be able to discuss with more information in 30 years' time, American policy under President Trump towards North Korea, but be under no illusions, North Korea, China and Russia are all independent players in that respect. One has to have the level of sophistication of being able to understand that any president must act within the constraints. And you contrasted him with President Clinton. President Clinton's circumstances were easier because at that period Russia was weaker, China was weaker, and North Korea was more cautious, as well as not yet having many of the weapons systems that it currently has. Now, I think we could very much criticize President Trump over North Korea, but we could also criticize President Obama and President George W. Bush, under both of whom North Korea was allowed to become, or take the steps that were to make it, a state not only with atomic weaponry, but also with delivery systems that would enable it to be able to deliver ordnance onto American garrisons at Guam and then into Hawaii and now apparently onto the West Coast. And there are allegedly, although nobody's yet clear that they could be weaponized with nuclear weapons, to get to the East Coast. Now, were you to regard that as the major requirement of an American president, which is the defense of their own citizens from foreign assault, which after all Pearl Harbor did rather clarify was quite important in the American psyche, then I think you can fairly say that President Trump failed to resolve the problem with North Korea completely, and he was obviously unsuccessful there. I think you can say that the circumstances were not easy for him, and you can also say that part of the blame goes with his predecessors, and you could make the point that operating in a multilateral fashion, and people at the present moment criticize President Trump for his transactional approach to international relations, well, operating in a multilateral fashion hasn't always worked either. And, you know, I have no particular brief for President Trump, and I find that some of his behavior is really quite disappointing, let's put it like that. I mean, I assume, you know, he's of an age, I assume he's disinhibiting. So I think, incidentally, it's really rather sad for the United States that they have a choice between an individual who appears to have psychiatric issues and another individual who appears to have had two heart attacks. So I'm not sure that this is exactly particularly wonderful. But, you know, if we're specifically looking at North Korea, I don't think you can simply say that Trump's policies are the only cause of the current mess.
And I wonder, broadening from North Korea to East Asia more broadly and to China specifically, I mean, clearly there's been a very clear turn away during Trump's period in the White House, a turn away from the view that engagement with China would make it a more liberal society. That idea has really been blown out of the water. But I wonder to what extent that illusion was shattered by Xi Jinping and Trump and Trumpism, if there's such a term in foreign policy, can be seen as a reaction to that rather than something which foresaw it.
Yes, I mean, to a certain extent, I mean, he's made his own messes, but to a certain extent, he's also carrying other people's messes. In ones we're referring here to policymakers in the West. I'm not saying that we would have done any better if Britain was a great power, incidentally. So, yes, I think that the I have argued this on when we've discussed on the sort of international relations, that the major reorientation of the 2000s was that China and Russia moved closer, that this restricted American options. And I would see what's going on at the present moment as another iteration of this. After all, if you look at the sort of difficulties of recent years, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but Crimea was under the Obama watch. I'm not saying by that Obama was a bad man or a bad president. All I'm simply saying is that a lot of the strictures used against Trump, many of them absolutely deserved, could equally well be applied to others. And one of the problems you've got is you've got this very crude analysis. Multilateralism works, it's great. Transactional bilateralism doesn't work. Well, you know, no. I mean, if life was that simple, most of us could write our one book and go home. But no, it isn't that simple. And I think that the failings, I mean, there are some international crises where I think the president has not always been tremendously helpful. But again, it's very unclear in the fullness of time how we are going to look at differing American policies towards, for example, Iran, or differing American policies in the Near East. And, you know, there is the broader question, which obviously concerns people who are outside America, which is that many people complain about America, what America does, but then want America to take a role in their particular idée fixe and national interest in international relations. So is it the case that under President Trump, you had a continuation, an accentuation, a diminution of whatever you might see of a previous period of moving away from commitment or intervention? Trump came in, if you will recall, very much on a sort of classic pledge to bring the troops home kind of thing, you know, rather like Eisenhower at the end of the Korean War or Nixon promising to bring Vietnam to an end, etc., etc. And you can, for example, if you like, fault him for saying that he didn't do that. Or you can say that he did it too much, or that you could say that he left these situations in a mess, or you could say they were left in a mess by President Obama, and in some cases Trump's made the mess worse, and in some cases he hasn't really made much of a difference. Now, I suspect you were asking the particular question about what historians will say, and I suspect that all of those various views will be offered.
Wonder what the perspective will be on the fact that the Trump presidency involved the United States in no foreign war in the context of the post-Cold War period. I mean, that is very noteworthy. Would that be seen as a manifestation of his bringing the boys home?
Well, there's all sorts of ways to look at that. I mean, I started off deliberately with North Korea because North Korea is the most serious. I mean, this is rather ironic because the North Korean economy is a pathetic economy. It's nowhere near the economy of China. But as we saw with the terrorist attacks on the United States in 2001, you can have a very weak force that can still do an enormous amount of damage. And the lethality at the disposal of the North Korean regime is quite acute at the present moment and growing more so. So, you know, you can play this through all sorts of ways. You could, as you may recall, President Trump at one stage was very much saber-rattling vis-a-vis North Korea. And you could play it through and say, well, maybe his great failings was that he didn't try a news force. I myself am not taking that viewpoint, but I'm simply saying, I'm trying to answer your question, which is, how is it going to be looked at in the future? And obviously, at the present moment, his rather pathetic attempts to, which is really quite disappointing for a public servant, which is what the president is, to throw doubt on other public servants trying to do their duty, counting ballots. This is rather driving out the greater complexity, which, I mean, there are many other issues which I hope we're going to discuss, and your listeners deserve to tell you off if you cut me short. But the you know, in this specific case of relations with North Korea, it is by no means clear, and the same thing I would suggest vis-a-vis President Biden or President-elect Biden, that it will be by no means clear what one should think about the best way of approaching North Korea.
Well, one area of the world that has in the last 30, 40 years or more been seen as central to American foreign policy is the Middle East. And one of the things that struck me about this presidential election campaign was relatively how little focus there was on the Middle East beyond some an interest in the withdrawal from the Tehran nuclear deal. Is this evidence that actually the Trump presidency involved a significant disengagement from the Middle East, or is it more a sign that actually America managed to handle it in ways which didn't draw it further in a way that could have caused a greater confrontation?
Well, that again is a very interesting question. I mean, I think Trump started off with a lot of blather, which was rather characteristic of him. You know, he was going to bring peace to the Middle East. He had a new peace plan, etc., etc., etc. And you will recall his son-in-law was cast in that role, and it was an attempt allegedly to try and arrange differences between Israel and Palestine, and that certainly didn't work. So I'm not saying that anybody else would have done it any better, but I'm simply saying that that didn't work. What has, of course, happened, and here I understand that the Americans have taken quite a significant role, is in the rapprochement between Israel and a number of the Gulf states. And that has, to a significant extent, altered an aspect of the Israel-Arab tension. So, you know, that element needs to be considered. Certainly, Trump has followed an inconsistent and ultimately unsuccessful series of policies in Syria and Iraq, and vis-a-vis Iran and vis-a-vis Turkey. But it has to be said that that was equally true of his predecessor, President Obama. And it has to also be said that in the case, certainly, of all of those, both the state actors and the non-state actors there, he has been dealing with, as President Obama did, distinctly difficult individuals and groupings, and those who don't necessarily have to address any domestic constituency or any democratic domestic constituency, in the sense they might have elections, but they beat people over the head if they don't vote for them, viz. Iran. It's genuinely seems shameful the way that some of the Kurds were let down. That does seem to be very shameful. Again, though, there is a pattern in the Middle East, and elsewhere in the world as well, of course, in which people that don't have the ability to be independent in states are often brutalized by others. And again, we can criticize the United States over this. I think it's fair to say past American administrations haven't always done marvelously, and the same is true of European counterparts. Can we just talk about briefly what I would call near America? I think one area in which the president's mood music, if one might use that term, has been pretty unsympathetic is a sort of rather bullying tone in what the Americans call the Caribbean, and also as far as Central America and Mexico is concerned. And it's also worth bearing in mind that despite exerting pressure on the kleptocratic criminal regime in Venezuela, he's been singularly unsuccessful in dealing with that. And this indeed is ironic. I mean, on the one hand, the president is held up to be, as he is, an aggressive bully. But on the other hand, where aggressive bullying might possibly have a cause, though I'm not urging people to go to war, but, you know, it didn't work, or it hasn't been applied in as it might have been applied in the past. And I think that is, you can definitely see that in Venezuela. I would also say that I'm not convinced that President Trump's Cuba policy was any more successful or intelligent than President Obama's Cuba policy. They were different, but in both cases, we've ended up still with a dictatorial one-party regime very close to the United States, and that's not desirable. But in part, what one's talking about is the limitations of power. And obviously, I'm assuming that Biden becomes president, it will be very interesting to see whether he is able to deal with these problems. And, you know, the mood music might be better. He might get himself a Nobel Peace Prize in contrast to Trump. He might well talk about multilateralism. But in a sense, if you're looking for stability and freedom in Iran or Venezuela or Cuba or the continued territorial integrity and democracy in Taiwan or restraint on North Korea, that will be much more of a test of President Biden than any amount of appropriate mood music.
One thing that struck me very forcefully during this presidential campaign was really what a backseat foreign policy played. Do you think that that is because the Democrats conceded that Trump, this was not the area to attack Trump on, or and that, you know, he'd at least kept America out of fresh confrontations. Or was it actually there's just so much going on at home, the focus on the economy, COVID, you know, the culture wars, and so on, that actually it's simply America has internalized its debate because of the divisions it has in its own country?
Well, again, that's very interesting. I mean, it was also true, I would put it to you, about the 2016 and 2012 elections. I would suggest to you that foreign policy wasn't to the fore. In 2004, 2008, obviously, there was a considerable amount to do with the legacy of the Iraq War over different timescales. 2096, there wasn't much to do with foreign policy. And in 1992, despite George H.W. Bush having just won the Gulf War the previous year, that wasn't enough to get him re-elected. So it may well be that we're talking about a more general pattern. Obviously, everybody then rushes round to talk about isolationism and all the rest of it. But, you know, again, look at our own country. I mean, concern about COVID seems to have driven out every and other all important other, issues that exist. So no, if we go back to the United States, as we've been talking about it, foreign policy to a certain extent is a matter not just of relations between the United States and foreign independent states, but also if you're sitting there in, let us say, Texas, and to a degree there is a foreignness about aspects of Washington or aspects of other parts of the United States, and the multivalent nature of the election and the way in which the electioneering takes place encourages that process. So, you know, there is this standard complaint from outsiders about Americans being parochial. I don't think Americans are particularly parochial. It is, as I've said, a continent pretending to be a country, and people are called upon and expected to have views about what is a very large area of over 300 million people. If you're asking about the particular nature of the election, I mean, what is striking is, and, you know, I assume the research will be there on split ticketing, but there does appear to have been enough split ticketing to help the Republicans do better in Congress than they've done in the presidency. And that must, if you want to think in terms of people's view of the presidency, that must reflect criticism of President Trump. On the other hand, he has had a lot of people vote for him. So that, again, is notable. As far as the specific thing about the electioneering around foreign policy, and, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but to a considerable extent, President-elect Biden kept his powder dry and, in a way, allowed Trump to sort of both dominate the airwaves, which, to an extent, both harmed Trump with a lot of American voters, but clearly inspired a lot of his supporters. And in a way, you could argue that Biden's prudence, or given that he's physically weak and allegedly, as I said, his health is in deterioration, this may well have been a very sensible response by him to both circumstances and to the nature and impact of the general COVID context. But I don't think that President Trump campaigned well. I think that he allowed his usual, I would say, unbalanced approach to many issues and personalities to come too much to the fore. One assumes he was given advice to try and keep quieter. I don't think that particularly worked. And he does appear to have disinhibited quite seriously. And this issue about health, it takes one, gives one no pleasure, as I've said, to say that neither man appears to be in good health. I mean, in the Trump, you know, Trump may well have survived his COVID robustly, but there is in the family, as is known, a pattern of Alzheimer's, and he does appear to be disinhibiting, in the sense that he was always fairly disinhibited, but it's going further. And President-elect Biden just simply doesn't appear to be up to the job. And I find that, you know, worrying, you know, as somebody that wishes well to the United States, where, you know, a significant amount of my family is, I find this a worrying context. And also it's worrying for those people who regard America, as I do, as the leading ally. And it's absolutely hilarious to listen to the former Belgian Prime Minister saying this should urge us to think more about Europe. If you look at the absolute mess of politics in countries like Spain at the moment, or Belgium, or Italy, and the idea that we are supposed to be encouraged to think that there is a obvious and viable alternative is, I think, farcical.
Mm-hmm. Well, Belgium famously went a year without a government at all. I wonder if we might turn to what the exit polls suggested was the single most important issue for voters, and that was the economy. And it's difficult to interpret what they meant by that. For some, they would have said the economy because of their worries about the COVID-related downturn. For others, they might be saying the economy because of the, in many ways, the good years that the Trump term of office involved in terms of a better economic performance than was expected. We talked last week a little bit about Bill Clinton's terms of office coinciding with economic good times. Do you think in a longer perspective that Trump will, when we look at his legacy, Trump will be seen as an economic good times president?
Well, I think that would be giving him too much credit, if you don't mind me saying. I mean, what's interesting about President Trump, and again, he's not unique in this, is he takes the credit when things go well, and it's always somebody else's fault when they go badly. And you might say that's an aspect of all social life. I myself would not. I think there were aspects of President Trump's economic policies which, in the sense of a low regulatory environment, probably helped economic growth. And I think certainly his pressure to keep money loose, money supply loose, which, of course, I mean, the same thing's going on in Britain at the present moment, helped the economy. But I think that the kind of very parlous circumstances, which he correctly analysed and discerned, others had as well, of course, in 2016, and which I'm afraid Hillary Clinton proved very lacklustre or unsuccessful at being able to understand, let alone address, to wit, the extent that large parts of America had suffered very badly from deindustrialisation, and that globalisation, whilst it was obviously beneficial to some, was quite seriously not for others. Whilst I think President Trump understood that, he wasn't able to really produce solutions to it. Now, that might well be to imagine far too much for what you can anticipate from any president, whether you like them personally or dislike them personally. But I think that that was a significant factor. Now, there were, if you look at the specific period of the campaign, some really indicative remarks. I mean, I thought Trump was successful at being able, I mean, to highlight the extent to which the energy policies of the Democrats, which may well be benign in terms of climate warming, nevertheless did directly threaten American jobs. And I think that's true. And what the point there is to bring out a wider question, which obviously resonated from the previous electoral campaign, presidential campaign, which is, you know, do the Democrats care about ordinary Americans? Well, the answer is, of course, they care about ordinary Americans, but they're not always able to articulate that terribly well. And that itself is interesting, and that itself is a challenge for them. What else did President Trump do well? Well, I was asked beforehand what I thought was going to happen, and I said I thought the polls were totally misleading. I said I thought that it was going to be an extraordinarily close-run race. I thought Biden would win, but I said I thought that if there were significantly increased rioting in the last days or weeks, that might well help Donald Trump. And I think the subliminally, that probably was something, though I'm not sure that people always want to own up to that at the voters. And, you know, I thought one of the most disappointing aspects of America in the last few months has been the policy on both sides towards rioting. The president has obviously thrown fat on the fire on a number of occasions, going right back to the Charlottesville episode. And I think his policies and rhetoric has at times been not only shameful, but also directly unhelpful. And I'm afraid to say, I think the Democrats have also been fairly disgusting, because instead of every time there is a riot saying this is absolutely outrageous, rioters should be locked up, being angry about racism is no excuse for burning down your own neighborhoods, a lot of Democrats have been very quiet about taking that viewpoint. Now, again, you see exactly the same thing in Britain, so I'm not in any way criticizing the Americans on that viewpoint. But if you're thinking about what is likely to resonate with voters, all I'm trying to say is you shouldn't be surprised at the departure from the major projections that were made in the polls. I think that there were issues in which President Trump clearly was appalling. I think he was appalling over COVID. I think his personal integrity is rubbish. I think he's a man who has no grasp on how to get on with people and how to be head of the federal system, federal bureaucracy. But I think also that in terms of what is referred to as culture wars, I think the Democrats were absolutely appalling. They clearly contain many individuals within their ranks who do not have a happy view about America's continuity traditions, and who seem to be willing to take the criticism of the American system to a completely disproportionate level. And clearly, people within the United States voting will have their own difficulties. I mean, so often people vote both for things and against them. And to that extent, Biden was a very good candidate, because he obviously has problems and issues in some respects. He's a clapped-out politician. In some respects, he's been passed over before by the Democrats. So, you know, many Democrats this time didn't want him, etc., etc., etc. So there's lots of problems with Biden. And we're leaving aside completely, because I really am not particularly aware of them in the sense of wishing to talk about them, some of these issues to do with his son and all the rest of it. So clearly, he has his flaws, but quite frankly, those flaws were less egregious than the ones associated with President Trump. So you can look at it another way round and say that Trump became president in part because of the message he offered last time, but in part because Hillary Clinton appeared to, fairly or unfairly, to be out of touch, arrogant, etc., etc., etc. And you can say that in this time, it looks as though Senator Biden will become president, having been president-elect, because in part Donald Trump is so woeful and is continuing at the present moment to underline the problems he poses. Now, that then takes us to the next question, which is a very interesting one, is the contrast between the presidential election and the congressional elections, both for the Senate and for the House. And here I think it's very interesting, because it is shown that just as it were, a particular aggressive form of populism in the form of the personality of, and views of President Trump did not prevail. So a very ugly populism in the form that a sort of, you know, the, shall we say, the more lurid corners of the left of the Democrat Party did not prevail either. And that, I think, is very, very interesting. Now, it does represent a problem for the United States in the sense that always when you have a division between the parts of the government, you have problems. And this is particularly so given the need to address COVID economy and international relations, let alone other things. But on the other hand, it may well work out in the sense that the Biden presidency, and let us assume and hope that President Biden's health holds up, but if it doesn't hold up, then the vice president will succeed him. A Biden presidency, given a situation in which Congress may well have a degree of blocking or thwarting some of the domestic agenda, may well perforce focus on international relations, and hopefully so to the good. And secondly, it may well encourage a form of congressional arithmetic in which the Democrats seek, Democratic presidency seeks to work with the Republican Congress. Now, that's never easy, and all too often in the past, each side has blamed the other, whether Democrats or Republicans, and that hasn't worked out terribly well. And, you know, we see the same sort of process now in our own country's politics, as in divisions between the Westminster authorities and the Edinburgh authorities, for example. So, you know, different authority systems don't always reconcile, even in the face of real problems. But, you know, one can at least hope that that will cause some sort of resolution. I mean, clearly there are problems for both the Republicans and the Democrats in Congress. Each side will have to try and get some sort of cohesion at a time when that's harder and harder, when party discipline is weaker. These are practical problems with running Congress. And of course, the background may well be economic difficulties, in which people do feel that they have to, or culture wars issues, in which they feel they do really have to defend positions, even at the risk of endangering coalition practices. So those are practical issues for us to think about. I mean, I think from the point of view of President Trump and the point of view of the Republicans, which are not the coterminous, of course, if, as looks likely, Trump has lost, he largely has to blame himself. I mean, quite clearly, the skill and success of many of the Republican congressional candidates reflects a willingness of the electorate to support Republican candidates and to argue that aspects of Republicanism speaks to their identity and in interests. And clearly the president, although he came close, wasn't able to do that the same, and the margin may well be a reflection on his personality, including how that came through during the campaign. And if that is the case, he has got nobody to blame but himself. I mean, one of the flaws about Donald Trump is that he is very keen to always blame other people, and that's not a tremendously attractive thing, and it also shows a sort of rather weak personality. You know, you should just take it on the chin, keep going, you know, shake it off. I'm afraid his habit of, you know, shouting out at all stages and at every stage has not worked very well. What this does mean, though, of course, is it creates opportunities for Republican politicians to consider how best to present themselves to the next election. I mean, the idea has been voiced that he should run again. That's impossible. I can't see that happening for a second. And it may well be that what this election has shown is that the American public, those of them who voted this time, and it was a record vote, though clearly a lot of Americans still didn't vote, but those that voted this time are more right-wing or conservative or Republican, whichever phrase you wish to use, than the Democrat Party. And that the Democrats were able to gain the presidency because of the deficiencies of the particular Republican candidate. If that is the case, that poses a real problem for the Democrats, because they found themselves in this electoral seeks sequence with really candidates such as Sanders or Warren, who essentially spoke to base rather than to the American people as a whole, the same as one could say as many Republicans. So I'm not making a party throughout. I'm not making a party political point here. I think given that that situation is the case, that may well pose some really serious issues for the Democrats. Now, if they win, as it looks likely, the presidency, and then can all have a nice scramble as to sharing out offices among themselves, they may well not be inclined to do that, but they need to start thinking about that if they wish to put themselves in a position to win the presidency next time round.
Well, the Democrats find themselves with two legacies which they wish to inherit. One is the Republican majority Senate, but the other is the Supreme Court. It is now, I think, by most calculations, a 6-3 conservative over liberal judges in the Supreme Court. Is that an area where you think Trump's appointees will be seen as an absolute vital part of a long-term legacy which could last for years and maybe decades?
Well, I don't think it's always helpful to think of the Supreme Court simply on partisan lines. And there are cross currents, as you know, within both conservatism and liberalism. So there are, if you wish to use the term, it's not an appropriate term, split ticketing among the judges. I'd be a little wary. I think, again, that's a slightly glib approach. I know that it's been much voiced by commentators, but I think that's a slightly glib approach. There are, I mean, obvious tensions on the right is between libertarianism, which is a conservative principle of freedom, as much as it were, religiosity and social cohesion as a set of conservative principles. That would be difficult for any set of justices and doesn't necessarily resolve itself into a simple conservative liberal one. And similarly on the left, a lot of the left like to make critical remarks about authority, police, etc., there is an awareness that on the whole rioters and demonstrators and people that talk about freedom often are bashing other people over the head, and that isn't the other people's freedom. So I think there are practical problems with both traditions, if you like, and it will not necessarily be the case that you would think of a Trump legacy in this respect. And again, if you're thinking about President Trump, I mean, alongside all his inadequacies, he's not what you would call a systematic thinker. Now, I'm not trying to be condescending there. I'm simply making the point that you can find within his various speeches, tweets, and so on, remarks that speak to very different strands of conservative thought, and some of them to what we in Britain might regard as non-conservative thought. And given that that is the case, that leaves a wide margin open for saying that his legacy is this or that or the other. And I would say, I mean, he's not the first of the non-systematic thinkers to be president, but I would certainly say there is a very much a contrast there with the colder but more intellectually precise figure of his predecessor.
There's a large debate over to what extent Donald Trump is an aberration, and obviously that argument is given weight by if indeed it proves that he's a one-term president.
Can I just say, I'm not sure that I would be happy for any political system with the notion that there is a, as it were, a perfect identity, and that from that you get aberrations. The idea that you would have somebody who is not a full-time politician in their background becoming president, that has happened in the past, of course. The I would say, in the sense of aberration, I would say, I mean, it's more that, as I said, this issue that I think is going to come out, which is the one about the mental questions and the ones about his balance in that respect. I think that will come out, and that means that it's probably best that he is a one-term president. I mean, you know, again, I'm making this point irrespective of people's politics. And I think actually it would have been best if the Democrats had run somebody other than Joe Biden, given the health issues. I'm not convinced. I mean, you know, we can go back. I was going to play games and take down my Fighting for America, you know, my book on American history up to 1871, and I was going to quote you things, contemporaries, serious senior contemporaries' comments, and I was going to say, who are those? And you were going to supposedly think, oh, that's Donald Trump. And in fact, it was going to be, in the one hand, Jefferson, on the other hand, Jackson, both of whom in their own ways were, I mean, Jackson in particular. I mean, look at the sort of martial law in New Orleans, but Jefferson during the 1800 crisis was, you know, these are people who in their own way were violent in their language, paranoid in their dispositions, and extremely ugly in their methods and attitudes towards politics. So you don't have to imagine that Donald Trump has originated that. I think what you can fairly say is that of recent decades, Trump is different to recent presidents. I don't think he is necessarily more criminal than, you know, obviously there's likely to be criminal proceedings, I understand, in New York. I'm not sure that he would necessarily emerge as more criminal than at least one president who was reputed to have been involved. There was an article about this in the London Times, an op-ed piece by William Rees-Mogg about involvement in connivance in drug running. So, you know, I'm not sure that I would necessarily say that he is completely out of the norm, but certainly he was not somebody who was a fit and appropriate person to be head of the federal government. I don't think there's any doubt about that, and I also don't think he was a fit and appropriate person as part of that to be commander in chief. I think his abuse. I mean, generals make mistakes. Joe's generals who make mistakes should be sacked. Too many people are too deferential to the military. That goes without saying. But people that do their job and in good faith give advice to the president that he does not want should not be sacked for that reason. And I think the president, not only his judgment was flawed there, but his entire attitude as a person made him unfit to be president in those respects. What was ironic, of course, is how the Democrats completely ballsed up the impeachment proceedings, because there were in practice in elements like his conduct as commander-in-chief ones where he could possibly have been more clearly shown to have been acting in a flawed fashion.
Looking at him in the round, I mean, I think even his greatest defenders would not describe Donald Trump as a team player. Has there, in your long perspective of the occupants of the White House, has there been another president who relied less on his senior team?
That's an interesting question. I thought you were going to ask me a less impressive one, and I was going to be suggesting to you one or two figures from the mid-19th century and one or two figures from the late 19th century, and then coming up to the 1920s with those, you know, with President Coolidge and President Harding. So instead of a less with a team, now that's a very interesting one. Well, I think what I'd fairly say is until the expansion of federal government in the 1930s, 1940s, it's not really necessarily helpful to think of a team. The size of the government was so small. Often, as you know, vice presidents and indeed heads of particular government departments, which were often simply patronage fiefdoms, were sort of divvied out among political figures without any attempt to suggest that this should be a coherent group. So I think what one should rather be saying is looking at the last 50 years. And I think in that period of time, no, I think that President Trump has run the most dysfunctional presidency. I mean, obviously, as you know, there was criminality against, in constitutional terms, with President Nixon. There was widespread sense of corruption in the Clinton years. But if you compare President Trump with either the last two presidents, George Bush from the Republicans and Barack Obama from the Democrats, both of them were men who would, I think, be generally agreed, including by people who were their political opponents, as people who were men of greater probity, integrity, and dedication to the office as opposed to the personality. If you absent President Bush, if you look at the two Republicans that ran against President Obama, Senator McCain and Senator Romney, and Senator Romney is still, I'm delighted to say, in the Senate. These were both, again, men of great integrity. And I was listening to the 2008 speech which Senator McCain made when he conceded defeat to Senator Obama. And all I can say is, A, that was a great American, but B, the contrast with the current president is one which is shameful to the current president, but also indicates we're not here talking about party lines, because, of course, Senator McCain was a Republican and was running as a Republican. So I think the, you know, I feel sorry for those people that have voted for President Trump. I think that there is a lot that is really quite troubling about the Democratic agenda in some of its respects, particularly on the culture war side. I think Senator Biden isn't up to the job. But I think it's fair to say that President Trump was even less up to the job and had been given an opportunity to prove himself and really has not done very well. I hope those people who are Republicans who are listening and who feel irritated with me can at least take consolation from the fact that they have done extremely well, they've held Congress, and they have put in a very creditable showing for a man who in many respects didn't deserve it.
We have to draw this podcast towards a close, but I want to ask whether it is really right to think of Donald Trump as a Republican at all. Obviously, he's the Republican candidate, but he's been in different parties in the past. Was Donald Trump really the Donald Trump candidate who happened to use the Republicans as a flag of convenience? Or should we see him, at least within the long Republican tradition, or albeit in only certain ways?
Well, there's several ways I can say it. I could say, well, this is Tammany Hall wandering into federal politics, and that would be a sort of, you know, a property developer trying to take over the centre of Washington. That would be very glib. No, let's be sort of clear about this. First of all, as we discussed all along, American political parties, like their British counterparts, French counterparts, we're not making a national point here, are coalitions. And within those coalitions, you get different tendencies and people adapt to them. So that I think it's fair to say that President Trump, when he was a private individual, was not noted for his zeal for Christian evangelicalism, but he managed to reconcile himself and endorse a kind of politicized Christianity, which is very much the case that some Republicans like. So Donald Trump came across to that type of Republicanism in office. But yes, I think he was fundamentally saw it as a personal vehicle. And there I think I would contrast him with the previous Republican candidates. You know, if you go back, I mean, we're thinking of George H.W. Bush, Dole, George Bush, McCain, Romney, all of whom I think were people of much greater personal integrity, but also a greater commitment to what we would understand as both the Republican Party qua party in country, Senate, Congress, and more generally, but also to what we would understand as the range of Republican sort of policies, and indeed one might say virtues. And to that extent, I think we should see Donald Trump as different. It's worth bearing in mind that the Democrats nearly ran this time a candidate who himself had not been part of the Democratic Party for a while, and that was Senator Saunders, who, correct me if I'm wrong, stood for quite a time as a socialist in Vermont and not a Democrat. But, you know, the American political system is more porous than in some respects the British political system is, which is probably to its credit. But it does mean that political parties can be very much influenced by major figures who, shall we say, don't have their basis in the party. If I might just make one closing point here, though, for British listeners. We've been talking about problems in the American campaign. Do bear in mind that if Britain was a republic, it might well be the case that the presidential election was between the equivalent of Stephen Fry for the left and Jeremy Clarkson for the right. So I do think we have to avoid any sense of complacency from outside. It is for all of us to think, whatever our politics outside America and whatever our political sympathies within America, it is to think that it is genuinely best for the world if we have a safe, secure, powerful, and prosperous United States, and to wish it well under whatever happens in its politics in the next few years.
Well, Professor Jeremy Black, on that note, we must leave it there. But thank you very much for what has been a fascinating and illuminating series on the occupants of the White House.
If you've enjoyed listening to The Critic podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the offer of 3 issues for just £5 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.